God for His Spirit. Thank God for the Bible. Thank God for one another as we try to honor Him with our lives. If you want to follow along with the sermon on the app, there's a little sermon button. You can follow along with the scriptures that I'll be using this morning, or you can go back later this afternoon or later this week and review some of the things that we talk about this morning. Also, we have elders and their wives that are available for prayer. Anyone who has any spiritual need, you can dismiss yourself at this time out the auditorium and then over to my left, to the west side of the building, and they'll pray with you in one of the classrooms over here. We're grateful for those elders, those shepherds who are watching over us as well. Today I'm going to start a new series from the book of Exodus, the second book of the Bible. It is one of the most pivotal books in the Bible. To understand the whole story of the Bible, it is so critical for us to understand and to know the story of Exodus. It is an incredible story. It's a story of a nation, the Jewish people, subjected to oppressive slavery. It's a story of a Pharaoh who is willing to put to death innocent babies for his own self-interest. It's the story of the rescue of one particular baby who was adopted into a royal family. That son, Moses, of course, becomes an adult, and he sees the oppression of his people, and so he kills one of the Egyptians, and he becomes a fugitive. While he's out shepherding sheep in this distant land, he comes across this bush that is on fire but is not being consumed. And then God reveals himself to Moses through that burning bush. And the message is, you're going to go back to Egypt and you're going to confront Pharaoh and you're going to tell Pharaoh to let my people go. And so we have this power struggle between this shepherd, this fugitive shepherd, and this mighty Pharaoh. Then we have the story of the plagues, locusts, boils, flies, and all of these plagues that come upon the people of Egypt, culminating in the death of the firstborn of each family, except for those families that have the blood of the lamb sprinkled on their doorposts. And then eventually this nation is liberated. They come to the Red Sea. They don't know what to do. They have the Egyptian armies who have now changed their mind, and they're chasing them down. And then miraculously, God parts the Red Sea so that they can go through on dry ground. And when the Egyptians follow them, well, the sea closes again, and they are destroyed. God appears to these people in dramatic fashion as they're wandering around in the desert on this mountain, on Mount Sinai, and he enters into a covenant with these people that is sealed with one of the greatest law codes that mankind has ever known, the Ten Commandments. And then these people are instructed to construct a mobile worship tent, the tabernacle, where they will honor God while they spend the time in the wilderness. I mean, this is a book that is chock full of incredible stories. And those were just the highlights. The book of Exodus, as I said, is one of the most pivotal books in the entire Bible. It's one of the most compelling stories that the world has ever known and is a key in understanding the rest of the Old Testament. And even as we get to the New Testament, it's a key in understanding the ministry of Jesus, the sacrifice of Jesus, and especially lets us know some things about who God is. It's a continuation of the story that I've been talking about for several weeks, the story of this one man, Abraham. God made some promises to Abraham. Remember those promises? He says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to bless those who bless you, and I'm going to curse those who curse you. I'm going to give you a land, and through your offspring, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That promise was made to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12. He was 75 years old. He and his wife Sarah had no children and no hopes of having children, but God kept his promise and gave them a son. His name was Isaac. As Isaac grew, that promise that God made to Abraham, those promises were repeated to Isaac. Isaac has two children, twins, Jacob and Esau. Now it's through Jacob that God is going to fulfill this promise, even though Esau is the older of the two boys. But God chooses whom he chooses. And he chooses Jacob, whose name is going to be changed to Israel. And that, of course, becomes the name of this nation. This family really starts growing when Jacob, or Israel, has 12 sons. And this family is growing. All the while, this family is settled in a land called Canaan. And this was the land that God had promised to Abraham. Got a little map for you just to give you a point of reference here. There is the land of Canaan to the east of the Mediterranean Sea. Abraham started off to the far right in Ur. He and his family moved up to the northern part there, north center part of that map, to Haran. And that's where God appeared to Abraham and says, go to a land that I will show you. And then he goes to the land of Canaan. He goes south. And it's there that God makes the promises to Abraham and then to Isaac and to Jacob. And so this is the space, this is the location where the people of Abraham settle. But let's look at the beginning of the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, kind of sets up the historical scenario as we get into this book. Exodus 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel, the sons of Jacob, who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family. And here's a list of the 12 sons: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Then the other son, Joseph, was already there in Egypt. So at the beginning of the book of Exodus, we find the people not in the land of Canaan. They're in the land of Egypt. Go back to that map again, just show you where Egypt is. Go back a slide. There it is on the bottom left-hand corner. Not really that far, but of course, if you're walking it or riding on some type of animal, it is a good little distance. But it's over there to the, what's that, west, the southwest of the land of Canaan. But that's where the people of Israel are. And now they're 70, and they're soon going to grow over the course of time to thousands upon thousands. This promise is coming true. Abraham's family is really growing. But how and why are they in the land of Egypt? Well, that goes back to the 12 brothers. You probably know the stories. The 12 brothers didn't get along especially well with one particular brother, Joseph. Joseph was the 11th of the 12 sons, and he was his father's favorite. You know the story about how Jacob gave Joseph a special coat, the coat of many colors? None of the other brothers got that special gift, and so that seemed to make them a little jealous. There was another fact that caused friction between the older 10 and Joseph, was that Joseph had these dreams of grandeur. He'd have dreams that at one point in time that all of his brothers would bow down to him. He had another dream that at one point in time, not only the brothers, but his parents themselves would be bowing down to Joseph. So they had enough of this fancy-coated dreamer. So they sold him as a slave to the Egyptians. And they went back to their father, and they said that he had been attacked and killed by some wild animals. And that's how Joseph ended up in Egypt. But what about his family? How did his family end up in Egypt? Well, when Joseph was in Egypt, he did pretty well for himself. He did really well for himself. He was a good worker. He was honest, did everything that was expected of him. And he also made a name for himself because he had this gift of being able to interpret dreams. And so as years pass by, and it's a long story, read the end of Genesis, it's incredible, it's a very story that reveals to us that God is working in all of this. We've talked about his providence. But Joseph has this dream, this power of interpreting dreams. And so one day, Pharaoh has this very disturbing dreams about cows, skinny cows and fat cows eating each other. And he has no idea what this dream means. And so he calls people that normally have the ability to interpret his dreams, and no one can interpret the dream of Pharaoh. And then someone who works for Pharaoh says, you know what? I kind of remember this guy that I was in prison with that had the ability to interpret dreams. And so Pharaoh says, hey, let's give it a shot. And so Joseph is brought before Pharaoh to interpret this dream. The dream means this, that Egypt is going to experience 7 years of plenty. I mean, they're going to have so much food, they're not even going to know what to do with it. But then after that 7 years of plenty, there's going to be 7 years of famine. And so Joseph says, you know what we ought to do during this 7 years of plenty? We ought to save up food, put food aside, so that during the years of famine, we will have food. And not only that, that will leverage us just great with the other nations, because they don't have this insight and they'll have to depend on us because we have saved during the 7 years of plenty. Pharaoh says, wow, what a great idea. Joseph, you are in charge of that plan. And Joseph, in fact, is given the responsibility of being second in command of all of Egypt. The dream comes true. Joseph saves up all of this food. Meanwhile, back in Canaan, his brothers and his parents are experiencing the pain of the famine. And so, like all of the peoples to that area, they're sending delegations, they're sending family members to Egypt to get some food. And so Jacob says, hey guys, go to Egypt, get us some food before we starve to death. They go to Egypt not knowing what has happened to Joseph. For all we know, they believe that Joseph is dead, but they are reunited with their brother, who is now this person in charge of this food distribution that is going to save the world. Joseph's dreams are coming to pass because they actually come and they bow down before him, not even knowing that it's Joseph. He looks a lot different than when they threw him in the pit. But eventually Joseph reveals himself to his brothers and they're scared, but Joseph reassures them, hey, God was working in all of this. He sent me ahead of you to save people. You intended it for harm, but God intended it for good. So to make a long story short, and that may be too late at this point, but to make a long story short, Joseph invites his family to move to Egypt under the blessing of Pharaoh, and they are granted a special place to live, the land of Goshen. Is it on that map there? There it is, the land of Goshen. And so now the whole family of Abraham is gathered together in Egypt. They're given this very nice land where they can shepherd, where they can farm, and that's how the family got to Egypt. And they grow and they grow and they grow. Well, let's go back to the end of the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 50, 22 through 26. This is how Genesis ends. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all of his father's family. He lived 110 years and he saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Ephraim was Joseph's son. Also, he saw the children of Machir, son of Manasseh. That's another one of Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. They were placed at birth on Joseph's knees. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land that he promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made the Israelites swear an oath, and he said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place. So Joseph died at an age 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. So again, that's how they end up in Egypt. It's important to note that the time gap between the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus is about 300 years. And during those 300 years, the children of Abraham have grown into a nation of their own. So the book of Exodus is going to continue the story of this family of Abraham. And again, what a story it is. So for the next several weeks, we're going to journey with Abraham's family as the story unfolds in the book of Exodus. But before we do that, I want to spend a few minutes today with just some introductory material, just some background information about the book of Exodus. So let's start with the name. Why is it called Exodus? Well, the name Exodus means a way out. It's a natural title for this book because it's going to recount the Israelites' liberation from Egypt and their exodus to the land of Canaan. But that's not the only name that it has. The book has another name in the Hebrew Bible. In the Hebrew Bible, they would refer to the book of Exodus as, and these are the names of the Hebrew term, if my Hebrew is any good, Welah Shemot. You see, the Hebrew people would name books of the Bible after the first phrase or after the first word in the book. Kind of like when you save a Word document. Have you ever noticed when you save a Word document, it will by default name it with the first words that you have put in that document unless you change it? Well, that's how the Hebrew, the Jewish people, name their books. And so to the Hebrew people, the Jewish people, it's, and these are the names. They just shorten that sometimes to names or Shemot. But we call it the book of Exodus. That's a legitimate and it's a great title. What about the structure of the book of Exodus? There are 40 chapters in this book of Exodus. The first 19 are dedicated to God rescuing the people out of Egypt. And by the way, they're enslaved in Egypt. We'll get to all that in the weeks to come. But he's going to liberate them, and that takes 19 chapters. Chapters 20 through 24 is when they're at Mount Sinai, and God enters into this agreement, this covenant with this people. These are the terms of our relationship. And of course, the highlight of that is the giving of the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. But there are some other terms of the covenant that you see after that as well. And then there's a huge section in the book of Exodus from chapter 25 to 40 where God gives instructions for these people to build this structure that we call the tabernacle. It is a mobile worship site. It lets us know how important the worship of God is going to be to these people and perhaps how important it is for us to prioritize worship in our lives as well. All right, who wrote the book of Exodus? For the most part, people have concluded that Moses is the author, not only of the book of Exodus, but of these first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And even though there are five books, a lot of times they're regarded as one whole. Sometimes they're referred to as the Pentateuch, you probably have heard that term, or the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, all are ascribed to Moses. Actually, the book is anonymous. Moses doesn't sign it at the end, and there's no direct statement saying that Moses wrote this book or any of the other books of the Pentateuch, but there are some passages in Exodus that seem to indicate that Moses is writing things down. Let's look at some of those passages. Exodus 17 and verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered. And make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven." So God tells Moses to write some things down. Exodus 24 and in verse 4. Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning, built an altar, etc., etc. But Moses wrote things down. Exodus 34, 27 and 28. The Lord said to Moses, "Write down these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel." Moses was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights without eating or drinking. He wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. So Moses is writing these things down. What's even more convincing to me when we get to the New Testament and Jesus refers back to this book that we refer to as Exodus, he attributes that and all these first five books to Moses. It's good enough for Jesus. Good enough for me. Listen to what Jesus says in Mark chapter 7, verse 10. "For Moses said," and then he quotes one of the Ten Commandments, "Honor your father and mother, and anyone who curses their father or mother is put to death." Moses said that. Moses is responsible for recording that for us. And then in Mark chapter 12, 26 and 27, Jesus is in this discussion about resurrection. He says, "Now about the dead rising, have you not read in the book of Moses?" And again, that may be referring just to Exodus, but more than likely it's referring to these first five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And then he talks about that account of the burning bush, and he says, "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." They're not dead. I mean, they're dead, but they're not dead. They're still living. And so this is how the discussion of the resurrection takes place. So when did Moses write it? Well, when we know the story, they hang out in the wilderness for 40 years. And so many people assume that during that 40-year wilderness wandering, Moses had plenty of time. What else is he going to do? And so it was probably during this 40-year period that Moses records these words that we know as Exodus. Now let me just pause and say there have been people who have challenged Mosaic authorship of Exodus. And there are some issues. In fact, at the end of Deuteronomy, Moses' death is recorded. Did Moses write that prophetically? Did someone come in? You know, it's very likely that someone came in and edited that portion to include that and kind of put a bow on the story of Moses. And so there are some challenges and some legitimate questions that we have to address. But there are many people that claim that this book, the book of Exodus, was written hundreds of years after the events that they describe. Perhaps during the time that the people are in exile. And so you will hear people that will say that this was written just kind of to give Israel some pride. They needed a good story. They needed to have some origin story about how they got to the land of Canaan. And there may be some truth to it, but for the most part, it's myth and legend. It's been written long after the events. There are many people, and increasingly more and more people, who question the history of Exodus, and for that matter, many are questioning the history of much of the Old Testament. But here are some objections you might hear. Hey, you start talking, hey, a preacher's preaching about Exodus. They'll say, do you really believe that stuff? I mean, do you believe anything that's written in the Old Testament? And in particular about Exodus, they may say, you know, there's some things that may not jive exactly with what we know about Egyptian history, because Egypt was a mighty power and they wrote down a lot. I mean, we know probably more about Egypt than we know about many of the ancient cultures. And some people will say, yeah, we're not sure. You can't believe that. It doesn't fit with Egyptian history. And they'll say, we don't even know the date of the Exodus. You know, there are different theories about when they left the land of Egypt. We don't even know exactly who the Pharaoh was. The Pharaoh is not named in the book of Exodus. We don't even know the route of the Exodus. Where did they go? We don't know where they crossed the Red Sea. We don't know. We don't have archaeological evidence or enough archaeological evidence about people wandering in that wilderness for 40 years. And so there will be many, many objections that you would hear when you talk to non-believers about the historicity of the book of Exodus. We don't have all the answers. But let me discuss why we may not have all of the answers. It's important when we read through the book of Exodus, it's important to recognize what type of literature that is. Much the same way that when you pick up a book, you understand what kind of literature that book is. When you go into a library, when you go into a bookstore, when you go on Amazon searching for books, there'll be different categories: fiction, nonfiction, biography, historical fiction. So when you buy a book, you understand the type of literature. So if you buy a biography, well, you figure, hey, there are some facts, and you expect to see some dates and things that actually happened that are verifiable historically. If you buy a how-to book, then you rely on that material that you do this and this is supposed to happen, and you get steps, and it's a different type of literature. When you buy poetry, well, you read that in a certain way. You realize that when you're reading poetry, this is not talking about reality. It's trying to produce some type of feeling or emotion or describe something to you in figurative language. If you read fiction, well, you know, these things really didn't happen. Now, there's historical fiction, and some of the facts or some of the details in a historical fiction work may be verifiable, talking about real places, but if it's pure fiction, you're not going to, I'm going to go look for that place. I'm going to take that road. If it's fiction, you realize that these things don't really exist. If you're reading a textbook, well, you understand. It's dry, hard facts. It's not going to be real entertaining. And so we have to consider that when we get to the book of Exodus. Let me use another example. If you were to ask, if you were flying, let's say you flew from London to Dallas, and you ask me to pick you up at the airport. I pick you up at the airport, and I ask you the question, how was your flight? And so you may probably say things, you know, everything was on time, the seat was real comfortable, you know, the person next to me was a little gabby, there was a baby behind me, you know, the food was pretty good, hey, watch this movie, and you would give me those types of details as I ask you that question. But if I were a pilot, and you were a pilot, and I picked you up at the airport and asked you, how was your flight, then your response probably would be a lot different. You'd probably talk a lot about the technical aspects of flying And I don't even know what pilots talk about, right? I had to change altitude because of some storm or whatever was going on. Or air traffic control told me to change my course X degrees so I would miss a storm. Or, oh man, the air traffic on the East Coast was just really crazy. I don't even know what pilots talk about. But if two pilots were talking about their flight, it would be a lot different than if just two non-technical passengers were talking about the flight. And so what type of literature is the book of Exodus? Let me tell you what it's not. It's not Egyptian history. That's not the purpose. Exodus was not written so that we can get insight into the Egyptian dynasties. And it's not political history. Exodus was not written to let us know how all these nations were interacting with one another and give us some commentary as if we're watching some news channel to know what king is saying what to another king and what are the interactions of the nations. It's not political history. It's not a travel atlas. Exodus was not written so that we could go back and we can see all of these sites and to get a picture of what it was like necessarily in the wilderness or crossing through the Red Sea. In fact, there's very little detail about how the sea was parted. And it's not a science textbook. It's not trying to explain, well, where did all those frogs come from? You know, how about all those plagues? That is not the purpose of the book of Exodus. Now, let me reiterate this, or let me make sure I communicate this, is that there's nothing in Exodus that contradicts what is known secularly. Now, there's a miraculous element to the book of Exodus, and we need to accept that. Let me just put this slide up here. If you're interested in some of the questions about the historicity of the book of Exodus, there is this series that is available on Right Now Media called Patterns of Evidence, and it talks about Egyptian history, how it jives with the story in the book of Exodus, and trying to make more sense about that. I've seen this. I would recommend this resource to you as you prepare yourself for some of these questions that you may encounter. Well, as I said, there's a miraculous element to this book, but here's what we believe. And remember, these are our foundational beliefs. We believe that God created the heavens and the earth, right? We believe that. We believe that God not only created the heavens and the earth, but in our discussion about providence, we believe, and I'm speaking for me, but I'm assuming you agree with me on this particular issue. We believe that God not only created, but he's active in the world today. He's still moving. I mean, we see that constantly, consistently through the Bible. So if God created the earth and he's active, it's not a big leap to say that he can make frogs appear or he can part seas. I mean, when we come from it from that angle, the story of Exodus does make sense in the kind of God that we believe in. So there's nothing in Exodus, outside of the miraculous element, there's really nothing in Exodus that contradicts what is known secularly. In fact, although we do know quite a bit about Egyptian history, we don't know everything about Egyptian history. It's not like we have all of these details. And a lot of people who are going to attack the book of Exodus are coming from the stance they don't want to believe, or they don't believe in a God who created, they don't believe in a God who is interacting, and so naturally the book of Exodus makes no sense to them. But there are some things that we know about Egyptian history that really coincide with the book of Exodus. Egypt really existed. There were pharaohs. And there are even some things from Egyptian history that make people their heads and wonder, maybe this is referring to some of the things that are discussed in the book of Exodus. There are some people groups that have been discovered as people have studied Egypt. There's these groups called the Habiru. They were a Semitic people. They were from that land, the land of Canaan, and they had some type of interaction with the Egyptians. We don't know who the Habiru was, but some people do notice that Habiru in Hebrew kind of sound alike. So some people think that in Egyptian history that the Jewish people are mentioned. It's not conclusive, but it's out there. It is known that Egypt used forced labor for their construction projects, much like we see in the book of Exodus. There's another group of people mentioned in Egyptian history called the Hyksos, the sea people. And at some point they came in and they ruled part of Egypt, which lets us know that at some point, Egypt was not as stable politically as we may think that it was. And so there's a lot of information that we don't know about Egypt either. And so there's a lot of people that when you start discussing the book of Exodus, will just say, that can't possibly happen. And a lot of times those are biased comments that they're making based on their refusal to believe in a God who created and a God who continues to work in this world. All right, so what is the book of Exodus? It's not Egyptian history, it's not political history, it's not a travel atlas, it's not a science textbook. The book of Exodus is a story about God. God is the main character. And in Exodus, we learn some things about God. And so Exodus is what some people call theological history. It's about God. It's what the Bible is. The Bible is about God and to lead us into a greater knowledge of who God is. Here are some things you're going to learn from the book of Exodus about God. God is a promise-keeping God. He made those promises to Abraham. He's fulfilling those promises to Abraham. He keeps those promises. We're going to learn that God is greater than any earthly kingdom. No one can stop God, even Pharaoh. In fact, there are passages, and they're difficult to understand, but there are passages where Scripture says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. God is making Pharaoh do what God wants Pharaoh to do. And again, I don't understand everything about that, but Pharaoh is no match for God. There is no nation, no kingdom that is greater than God. And we see that throughout the rest of the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar, Caesar, no one is greater than God. God is a promise-keeping God. God is greater than any earthly kingdom. And God has a purpose for his people. He's going to bless the world through this nation. Ultimately fulfilled in the coming of Jesus Christ, as Paul writes in Galatians. But as God is taking people out of Egypt into the land of Canaan, it's described as a beautiful land, but he's not taking them from Egypt to Canaan for a vacation. He's taking them from Egypt to Canaan so that they can witness to the world about who God is. And ultimately, he's preparing this land to receive Jesus Christ, the Savior. God is a promise-keeping God. He is greater than any earthly kingdom. God has a purpose for his people. Let's bring this home. God will keep his promises to you. As we read through the book of Exodus, we can be assured that the promises that God has made to us, he is going to keep those. He is faithful. He's promised to provide a way out of temptation. He will do that. He will always provide a way out of temptation. He has promised that he will give you his spirit so that you can produce the fruit of the spirit. He's going to do that. He has promised that he's going to work all things together for good. He is going to do that. God is going to keep the promises that he made to each one of us in Scripture. So never give up on God. God is greater than any earthly kingdom. Let's admit it. We're all a little nervous right now, aren't we? When we watch the news, when we see what's happening between Russia and Ukraine, it's a little scary. God is more powerful than Putin. I mean, that's the truth. He is more powerful than any earthly kingdom. And I'm confident that God has a plan, and there's no power on earth that is going to fluster that plan. And God will do what he wants to do in order to accomplish his purposes through whoever he wants to, no matter how powerful they are. God is greater than any earthly kingdom. And that gives me a sense of peace and hope when I see what's going on in the world. God still has a plan. And then God has a purpose. He has a purpose for you. God has a purpose for the church, universal. God has a purpose for the Park Avenue Church of Christ. And God has a purpose for every person who is called by his name. And just like with Israel, he is not blessing the nation of Israel so that they can have a vacation. He has not blessed you so that you can have a vacation. He has not given you what you have so that you can just sit back in a lounge chair and say, wow, isn't God great? We should do that. We should recognize that. God is the giver of all good gifts. He blessed you for a purpose. He has put you where you are for a purpose. Maybe it's bringing someone closer to Christ. Maybe this is that one person that Lance is talking about. Maybe he's intersecting your life with someone else so that they can know the power and the glory of God. All of these kids that left before the sermon time, maybe it's your purpose to help them understand God, to teach them and just encourage them, or to recognize that we're providing through this church resources so that our kids, so that our youth group, so that people that come through this body of Christ can know who God is. Maybe it's showing God's love through serving people. We've talked about in PAWS or in our college age ministry or whatever it may be. Maybe that's your purpose. Maybe it's your purpose to help someone through a struggle and just remind them, you know, that you're at the edges of this Red Sea. God's going to part it, and he's going to make it all right for you. But God has a purpose for you. So as we look through the book of Exodus, even though this is an ancient story, let it speak to us as well. This is a story for us because we are a continuation of the story. God is still working. He called Abraham, he called his family, and he's calling us as well. We are part of this story. We, as Paul would say, we are the children of Abraham. And it's through the church that God is demonstrating his manifold wisdom. He's accomplishing his purposes. So as we go through the book of Exodus, I pray that this story will help you become even more committed to serving this great and this powerful God as we continually offer ourselves up to him. Let's stand. Let's sing.
We lift our voices, we lift our hands, we lift our lives up to you, we are an offering. Lord, use our